It's time now for KMTS Connections, a public affairs program from KMTS News, heard weekdays around 12:30, bringing you interviews and information regarding local nonprofit events and city and county services from Aspen to Rifle. KMTS Connections connects you to everything that matters in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond. Once again, it's Gabe from the KMTS Morning Show. Kind of a multifaceted conversation today. Jenny Harrington is the membership chair for the Holy Cross Cattlemen's Association. Suzanne Stevens works for Aspen Valley Land Trust. Matt Yamashita is the Area 8 Wildlife Manager for Colorado Parks and Wildlife, the Division of Wildlife, if you will. Jenny, the conversation today is kind of based on Holy Cross Cattlemen and your place in a growing and changing economy, right?
Yeah, the growth that we've seen in Colorado has been really exponential, and we like to look at what ranching is providing to their communities. A lot of times folks will just think, okay, they're providing beef. They may be providing it locally or it goes somewhere else once the calves are weaned, but it goes beyond that because ranching provides a haven or a refuge for wildlife. It provides open space, scenic view sheds. There's many things that ranchers provide, and we want folks to know that we enjoy doing that, we like doing that, but sometimes we're at risk at not being able to do that. And so we wanted to talk about the importance of the wildlife habitat and the working landscapes that you have in a ranch, and you know, whether it's water filtration, you know, the golden and bald eagles we see out on the ranch in the summer when we're haying and they're waiting to go grab up those rodents. So we just wanted to come out, kind of spread the word about what we do and talk about some of the wildlife and programs and concerns and visit about those things and just let folks know that what we do as a ranching community.
And, of course, when you're talking about preserving farmland for all of those reasons, one of the methods we have to preserve those is some kind of conservation easement
mechanism.
Yes, exactly. And, of course, Aspen Valley Land Trust helps put together those conservation easements. Do you have two complete books now, Suzanne, that you've put featuring a lot of the landowners in the area that have conservation easements on their lands?
Good memory. Yes, we've put out two books.
Well, my mom and my stepdad picked up the other one, so they showed them both to me like in the last week. Yeah, I can remember for a week.
Yeah,
much longer than that, and you're on, you know, chances are.
Yeah.
But these are great pieces. Do you actually sell these books with these showcases of the properties that have conservation easements?
Yes, we can get anybody a book that's interested. They're called Our Place and Our Place 2. And they are. They're just wonderful showcases of the folks that have conserved their land for a multitude of different reasons, which kind of speak to what Jenny was just alluding to. There are so many reasons to protect not just ranch land, but open spaces in general. But, you know, Colorado is about 60% private land. Garfield County is about 40% private land. And of that, quite a lot of that is ranch land, much less today than there was 20, 30 years ago. But that land is so critically important because of what it is. I mean, land that is private was generally homesteaded because of its fertility, because it's in low or mid-elevation areas that are the most fertile, that are actually provide a lot of the best habitat for wildlife as well as for people. So there's always been a tension as to these really sought after lower elevation areas, and the ranches are really what is still protecting that. So they're critical.
It's interesting that as time changes, how opinions change. From a water standpoint, farmland is considered a consumptive use of water under Colorado law, right? They're consuming the water, just like municipalities. And yet, we have these conservation easements that are trying to conserve that land so that it's not developed. And that brings in a number of different benefits, including an economic benefit, because one of the reasons why people love to come here and visit is because we have some of these wide open areas that are still considered farmland, and a lot of that land may be under conservation easements. I want to say, I just thumbed through the book, small acreages all the way up to a full section, 640 acre conservation
into the thousands.
I miss those.
This area doesn't have a lot of ranches left that are in the thousands of acres, but there are a few, and a few of them are under conservation easement. This is a busy, highly developed region these days that's got a lot of competing interests, and land tends to get divvied up and sectioned off. And I was at a talk the other night where there was a great quote given of how a habitat or an ecosystem is like a big Persian rug. And once you start chopping it up into one-inch squares, it sort of all unravels and you lose that integrity. And that's really a good visual for how the landscape can quickly deteriorate when you start inserting a lot of these human uses.
Speaking of conservation and changes of opinion, Matt, 20, 30 years ago, a lot of the species that we're talking about conserving now were actually considered nuisance species 20, 30 years ago, and that opinion is kind of changing somewhat with landowners.
Yeah, and it depends on who you talk to and their frame of reference. But definitely over the last couple decades and continuing now, the public opinion, public perception of different wildlife species has changed drastically. It kind of makes an interesting shift in management for us as a wildlife management agency. Specifically to our local communities here, 20, 30 years ago, a lot of these elk and deer herds that we long to see now, whenever they would show up in mass on some of these private ranches, they weren't as welcomed as they are now. Now, if people are seeing them, they want them there. They want to perpetuate them. They're realizing that now that they don't see 1,000 of them every single day, that it's something that they miss seeing. So we're working really closely. We're attempting to shift some of that those programs to work closely with private landowners, with ranches, especially with these large acre parcels, in order to conserve some of that, protect that land, perpetuate the wildlife resource, help make sure that complements what's going on with some of these private land practices. But we're having to go back and realign based on some of the community aspects and the public interest.
Context is such an interesting thing. Before we got started today, we're talking about elk in particular. I remember hearing, I think 25 years ago, Colorado has the largest elk herd in North America, right? And the comment was that the elk population is actually down 50%. I don't know from what point to what point. But you said actually we still have more elk than anybody else. It's just we have fewer of those elk.
Correct. We still, Colorado still boasts the largest elk herd in the U.S. However, compared to what it was, we probably have seen the peak of elk numbers in Colorado. We probably won't return to that phase or won't see that again. That was something that was heralded as phenomenal. It was something that, that was significant. That was kind of what put Colorado on the map amongst Western states. And we still hold that title. However, moving forward, something that we're having to relearn, rethink how we manage elk, what elk mean to the residents of Colorado, what elk mean to the visitors of Colorado, and then where we're going to go with elk management into the future. So I don't think it's realistic for us as a wildlife management agency, for us as the communities of Colorado, to expect elk numbers to get back up into the 300,000 plus animals that we used to know so recent as 20, 30 years ago.
We will take a quick break. We'll come back, and we're actually going to visit a little bit with State District 57 Representative Perry Will. You're listening to KMTS Connections. Welcome back to KMTS Connections. For this next segment, Matt and Suzanne will not be able to participate much as Colorado Parks and Wildlife and Aspen Valley Land Trust are apolitical in nature, so they're not allowed to make any political position statements, if you will. Joining us on the phone is State District 57 Representative Perry Will. Taking just a couple minutes here to visit with us. So, Perry, what's the latest from Denver?
Oh, just a lot going on. lots of bills, over 500 bills, and we're trying to sort through and do the good ones that benefit all the people of Colorado and and kill the ones that aren't. So it's pretty busy and a lot going on. We're almost about halfway through the session, and of course it'll get busier each day and each week from here on out. But it's been going good, and there's been some good bills go out of here, and I'm excited about some of the good ones, and we got some good environmental bills, I think, and some water bills that are good, and lots of other stuff that are gonna really benefit the West Slope, and that's obviously that's what I represent, and that's priority to me is the West Slope. But most of these bills are, we look at them from a perspective of benefit to all Coloradans. So.
I appreciate that. That's why you're where you are. And I am not, is your ability to tell the difference. Speaking of conservation, we've been talking a lot about conservation up to this point. You know, one hot topic, perhaps not at the state legislature, but something on a national level that's been discussed in the last few months, is the reintroduction of wolves in Colorado. Now, Jenny, Holy Cross Cattlemen, I assume, as most organizations like yours, are against.
Yes, we oppose, does Colorado Cattlemen's Association and working with other organizations in an issues committee formed called Coloradans Protecting Wildlife, which is Colorado Cattlemen's Association, Colorado Farm Bureau, Colorado Wool Growers, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and Safari Club International joined in there, too, for the Rocky Mountain chapter. And we've got some great information out there at a website called RethinkWolves.com. And we'd just like folks to think about, you know, is this the setting where we want to reintroduce wolves? And there already are wolves in Colorado.
Like in northern Colorado.
Northern
like
Colorado, yes. We've got in Moffat County a pack there. I think there's about six, and I know our Parks and Wildlife folks can, and Perry can speak better to that. And then a lone wolf up by Walden, and you know, those are here. Colorado Parks and Wildlife has had a plan for those wolves that come in on their own, and we support that. We don't think spending the amount of money that they're looking at, $6 to $15 million and beyond, to introduce wolves on top of those is a good plan. And we also look at the population in Colorado. We look at our declining elk numbers, our mule deer, moose, you know, the different wildlife that we do have here, and how we're trying to look at steadying those populations and some concerns with those, and ranchers supporting those programs and efforts to do that. So we are in opposition to the wolves coming in, and we just think it's not a good idea, and let's let those that have come in, let's work with those and see where that goes. There is a plan set up for that.
Now, Perry does have a very interesting perspective and context on this. Perry, it wasn't that long ago that you were wearing Matt's uniform. Well, maybe not exactly Matt's uniform, but something that looks a little similar, right?
it was one size larger.
Obviously, state employees are not allowed to campaign for or against any kind of political questions like the reintroduction of wolves. Now, as our state representative for District 57, obviously, it is your job to weigh all of these varying voices and vote based on what you feel. So what is your take and explanation of how we got to the point where we're talking about reintroducing wolves, and what do you think? Have you made up your mind yet about how you'll vote?
Yes, definitely. And I'm anti-wolf reintroduction. I'm okay with them moving in like they have on their own. And we do have a plan in place, and you know, maybe updating that wolf plan from those wolves that are immigrating into the state on their own. I'm totally against any introduction or reintroduction of wolves in the state. And you know, it's whether you like, you know, love wolves or hate wolves. That's not the point. The deal is the wolves. Let's say you love wolves. It's not fair to the critters. It's not fair to the wolves. Introduce them into this state. You know, we're looking at 5.8 million people in this state. There's not room for them. And, you know, we're not Wyoming. We're not Idaho. We're not Montana. this state is so populated, and the demographics and projections into the future, it just wouldn't be fair to the species. And us as CPW and wildlife professionals, anytime we do an introduction or something or a reintroduction of a species, there's all kinds of habitat assessments that's done, and all these socioeconomic things are looked at and studied, and to make sure they're going to be successful if we do introduce them. And you can look at lynx, you can look at black-footed ferrets of recent times, but wolves, they just won't be successful. And the other thing, in our especially our ungulate population, from moose, deer, and elk, I mean, it's really they're gonna have an impact on that for sure. And they're already struggling, and a lot of the struggle that those species are encountering now and is due to population. So I don't need another apex predator on top of that. You know, we already have a robust bear and lion population, and so I just think it wouldn't be fair to wolves, and also wouldn't be fair to our present wildlife we have in this state. And I do oppose any wolf introduction, and I oppose the ballot initiative.
It sounds a little bit like, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but from a conservation standpoint, you're talking about managing the numbers and trying not to interfere with species in general. You know, we're talking in the first segment, we talked a lot about elk herds and that kind of thing. It sounds to me like you're saying they may be already migrating into Colorado anyway. Why speed up that process and then have a bunch of dominoes fall that we would have to kind of backtrack and deal with, as opposed to let things happen naturally without this huge change in population and ecosystems and that kind of thing?
Exactly. And if it happens naturally, fine. You know, and I'll go back to my statement. We already have, you know, we know that we already have a wolf pack in the state. But there needs to be a management plan on that. And I think most are okay with, hey, if they're coming into the state, let's pick a population level they think that we could potentially maintain, and then stick with that. But as far as introducing them, no. And I just don't think there's some remote areas of the state that they can be quasi maybe successful in, but there's not too many. It's there's going to be conflicts with those wolves and on many different levels, and that's why I'm opposed to it. I was in the wildlife business my whole career, and I like wildlife. Don't get me wrong, but I'm not for doing something to a wildlife species that I don't think will be successful.
What is the atmosphere? Do you get a feeling? Has this subject come up in the state assembly? Do you get an idea what the general feeling is?
I'd say that. So, yes, the subject is up. It almost surfaces every day in a committee hearing or somewhere. But and there's a Senate bill about it that's coming out. And I'm not in support of that bill yet. There's some amendments and some things going on it, and some different groups working on the bill. So it's getting better and better. And that basically that bill would hopefully pull back the ballot initiative. But we're not there anywhere close to that. But yeah, there's discussions daily, and you know, it kind of depends. Right now, I'd say from the legislative side, it's a little bit, it's probably 50-50, really. It's somewhere in the middle, those that would like to see them and those that wouldn't. It's not about whether you like wolves or not. It's more about the...
do you think this is really a sustainable plan?
Should we be doing this?
Sure.
Is it necessary? And I say, obviously, when we've proven, and CPW's proven, that there's an established pack in the state, I mean, to me... why on earth would you want to reintroduce them if they come here naturally? Doesn't make sense to me.
Fair enough. Perry, I know you're really busy. Thanks for spending a little bit of time with us. Jenny, did you have anything you wanted to ask Perry since we have him on the phone?
Well, the CPW has had a plan, I think, in effect for wolves that come in, and just this ballot box initiative Ballot Box Biology, as we're calling it, to introduce things without looking at the biology, not addressing the scientists that can do that. And I think Perry's spot on with, you know, the population. The land masses of wilderness-type areas is so much smaller than what it is in Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, when you put things together and that population pressure and stuff. So we want to, if we introduce a species, we want it to be fair to that species or give them a chance to make it. And it just sets them up for conflicts here. And as ranchers, we've been concerned about the elk and the mule deer, and we've worked with CPW on some of those projects. So it's just, you know, let's think about the things we're doing and how it does have domino effects. And
yes,
thank you, Perry.
I'll mirror those comments. I mean, and you maybe previously have already talked about ballot box biology, but that's the worst, absolute worst way to manage wildlife. Let the professionals manage the wildlife for us. That's why we have that agency, the top agency in the nation, and we have the top individuals and biologists and people working for CPW. Let them make the decision. They are the wildlife professionals. And this ballot box biology, not without getting into the history of it, I went through a couple of these, and neither one of them have come out good. So please, I beg the public to let the wildlife agency take care of this and vote no on Willis reintroduction.
Well, and as ranchers, we appreciate what CPW does and as Holy Cross Cattlemen, because they've worked closely with us. They keep in touch with us when there's issues and concerns, and Perry's done that too, being there in the house. He's let us know of things. He's tried to make our meetings or called in and been there for us to let us know what's going on, things we should be concerned about, things that we should be in support of, and we just really appreciate that. I know you're supporting all of Western Colorado and the varied needs, and we thank you for that, and we're proud to be able to provide wildlife habitat and corridors and such and work closely when, you know, decades ago that wasn't really the case, and we don't see them as a nuisance. We want to work with them and see those populations of our wildlife be steady and some places growing when they need to.
Thanks for those comments. Well said, Jenny. But I just want to say that I am honored and privileged to serve the people of House District 57 over here for all the things that have been talked about and everything else. So I'm honored and privileged to be here and be your representative. So thank you.
I'm always happy when a non-career politician becomes a politician. Wait, that didn't come out exactly the way I wanted to say it, but hopefully you understand what I mean.
Anyway, I do.
Thanks for your time, Perry. All the best. We'll see you around.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
We'll take one final break. We'll come back and wrap things up with Matt, Jenny, and Suzanne in just a minute. You're listening to KMTS Connections. Welcome back to KMTS Connections. Again, this afternoon, we're talking with Jenny Harrington. She's a membership chair for the Holy Cross Cattlemen's Association. Matt Yamashita is the Area 8 Wildlife Manager. So, Matt, is it still Division of Wildlife? I know it's a couple of years ago, you know, there used to be the Department of Natural Resources, and you had the Colorado Parks, and then you had Division of Wildlife, and they were merged together during, you know, one of those years when they were trying to cut back on some money, so they're trying to cut down on some middle management. Is it CPW or is it Division of Wildlife?
It officially, it's Colorado Parks and Wildlife. So okay. Since 2011, we've been a merged agency, okay. And half the agency is the former Colorado State Parks. The other half is formerly Colorado Division of Wildlife.
Okay. Well, I apologize because it's, you know, old habits die hard.
I still know what you're referencing.
And it's easier to say DOW sometimes because right. It just
yes.
comes out. And
exactly.
We've had that history. And
exactly.
History is important.
Absolutely. So I want to be clear in the last segment. Obviously, Holy Cross Cattlemen's Association is a little more political, I guess you might say.
Well, and we formed the Issues Committee. Colorado Cattlemen's Association formed an Issues Committee so they could do political, so to speak, campaigning and call folks and poll folks and inform folks. So they did form – you have to form a Political Issues Committee and be filed with the state. So Colorado Cattlemen's Association did that, and we're affiliate of Colorado okay. Cattlemen's Association and that group, Coloradans Protecting Wildlife. So, yes, we can come out and say that. And I know Suzanne wanted to comment too because they – are not taking a position, and we understand that. And
well, and not just Suzanne. I want to be very clear.
Others,
that
and Colorado Parks and Wildlife
Matt,
doesn't
yes,
take a
Matt,
position.
Yes, Matt, as employed by the state in his capacity, cannot make a comment one way or the other about pending legislation.
And beyond the facts of WOVES, what we really want to talk about too and what it all leads to is the things that we do, the ecosystem services that ranchers provide. You know, you talked about water use a little bit, and ranchers have worked to improve their water use, to put in pipes and sprinkler systems and big guns, we call them, and the different systems, new head gates, some put in concrete ditches and such to be able to use to conserve more water. But also we do have to make sure that in doing that we don't risk replenishing the groundwaters in those areas too. So it's a tricky deal. It's not as simple as folks say, oh, ranchers use a whole lot of less water and pipe everything and do that, because we have to look at
yeah, that has an impact on the groundwater.
It has an impact on the groundwater. So we're very cognizant of that. We work hard on programs with the SOPRIS, Mount SOPRIS, and the different conservation districts here, and Sherry Pro, and projects. In fact, Holy Cross Cattlemen's is going to have a meeting on June 11th, I believe. We're going to have some water folks in here, and we're also going to have resource monitoring, and we'll be in Rifle doing that, and I'll get more information out about that. But we're working hard to do the right things for our environment and be good stewards of the land, of the wildlife, of our cattle. And so that's really important to us, and that's, you know, with conserving lands too, that's important that folks have opportunity to keep those lands in to ranching and those open spaces. It may not be a ranch land. It may be another setup there. But Aspen Valley Land Trust does a good job working with those landowners.
Suzanne, Aspen Valley Land Trust, is it 40 years?
53 wow. years now, something like that.
What was the first parcel that you worked on conservation easement?
Me personally?
I mean AVLT.
Well, AVLT was actually founded as a parks organization in Aspen, hence
right.
the name. So we had a couple little tiny parks right in downtown Aspen. And gradually expanded and grew out from there, and we now protect land from Independence Pass all the way down to Debeck, close to the Utah border. So it's a massive region. Over the last 50 years, we've protected about 67 square miles, which is the distance from Aspen to Rifle a mile wide. And clearly, you know, the landowners are our partners in that. We own a few parcels ourselves, but they total about 100-plus acres. So ranchers are really the prime suspects for taking action to conserve that land. And without them, none of this would happen.
How would you define a conservation easement?
Conservation easement is simply a legal agreement between a land trust or a local or a state government agency that can hold a landowner accountable for how it uses its land in the future. So generally, it restricts development. It may restrict certain uses of the land. It does not restrict all uses of the land. So it works really well for a lot of ranchers because it still allows you to carry on your traditional ranching practices. But it guarantees that the land's going to stay intact and it's going to provide future possibility. I mean, that's really what this is all about, is not telling somebody how to do their job or how to manage their land, but by protecting possibility, you're protecting the future. And that literally translates to, yes, like what wildlife species are moving across that property. I mean, we're not taking a position on wolves. We're a non-political nonprofit and never would. But we protect land for all species, and we don't distinguish between what types of species are there. Now, clearly, the land managers and the owners are going to, need to control as they need to in order to carry out their operations. But really, what this is about for us is protecting space for ecosystem services and processes to take place, and for wildlife of any stripe to be able to move through theoretically.
And again, to be clear, Aspen Valley Land Trust is apolitical, so
correct.
You don't take a standpoint on any political. You're actually very similar to the CPW employees in that you wait and you see what the voters decide, what the state legislature decides, and I guess in Matt's case, the State Wildlife Commission decides, and then you implement whatever those rules and statutes happen to be, and directives.
Yes, this is true. And conservation easements are brought to you by the voters of Colorado, and the incentives that are provided to landowners for creating conservation easements are brought to you by the voters of Colorado. And there is currently some legislation in front of the state right now concerning conservation easements. And so that is something that we can support and actively work toward, because that is literally affecting the tools that we use to do our job. So,
I kind of have a mixed career, too, and I don't know if Susan's aware of it, but I worked for Black Canyon Land Trust as a Northern San Juan Initiative, the first director they had when we lived in our home area of Ridgeway and Montrose. I go back five generations there, and worked for also for the Ouray County Historical Society Museum. So I kind of have this mixed thing. I have ag business degree. I'm a rancher. I love that, but the historic part of it and communities, and sometimes land trusts can work with that too, historic buildings on a land site where they can work and preserve those. But it's all those things are important to community. There's the history wrapped up in the landscape there and the open space and the viewshed, what brings people to this area and preserving that. And there's the cattle there that we are able to provide local beef, we're able to provide a nutritious, healthy product. And in doing that, we're also doing other things that benefit the environment. And we have those wildlife herds, the elk, the deer. You know, we had bald and golden eagles, like I spoke about earlier. We've got coyotes and mountain lions and wild turkeys. We have quite a wild turkey population. Matt can speak to that, too, on the ranch where I live and that my husband manages. So we love those things. We're excited about those things. Those are part of our heritage and history. So we're trying to balance and do the best we can with those. So,
you know, it's interesting, too, because we've observed I've been with the Land Trust for 15 years and talking with a lot of old-timers and a lot of ranchers who've been around and seen several generations turn over in this valley and have seen a lot of changes on the land. But one of the changes that they've noted is hearing these tales of, well, you know, when my grandfather had this ranch, they never saw elk down in the pastures. They were always up high. And nowadays, the elk winter there, they calve there, and they spend a good portion of the year there. And Ginny, I think you can attest to that.
We have we watch and see when people slam on the brakes on the county road. We can see that from our house or the ranch proper there when they slam it on Thompson Creek Road, and they'll slam on the brakes, and then we know that the elk, the big bulls, are out there with the horses, and we watch the people going by, and they just stop. They want to see that, and we like seeing that too. Yeah. So
seeing an elk in front of you in a car is not something you'll soon forget. They look like about 400 feet tall.
Yeah.
Of course, with us, it was actually bobcats. When I was born, my parents would occasionally see a bobcat. They disappeared. When more people moved into the area, they had dogs and that kind of thing that would kind of chase them away. But now that we've got more and more development, they're starting to see bobcats every now and then at the neighbors' places.
It pushes them down because that was their habitat.
Exactly. Matt, CPW is such a multifaceted organization. As you mentioned, it was created with the merger of Colorado State Parks and Colorado Division of Wildlife. Obviously, you've got a law enforcement aspect, which is probably the most visible aspect of either organization, DOW or State Parks. But you have biologists that are counting deer, elk, and other species on a regular basis. They're doing research from time to time. I'm curious, how much of your time do you spend? Do you just manage the law enforcement arm of CPW, or are you just the overall area manager? Do you actually oversee the biologists and everybody?
So for our local operations here, I'm the area wildlife manager, the supervisor out of the Glenwood Springs office. I oversee all the district wildlife managers in the Roaring Fork and Eagle Vale Valleys, and all of our wildlife officers by trade are biologists as well. So every single one of our officers, as a prerequisite for applying for the position, they have to come into the job with a four-year biology degree.
Wow.
So while we do have terrestrial biologists, aquatic biologists, conservation biologists on staff, a lot of those biologists serve in a supplementary capacity, and they supplement the ground efforts, the field efforts that our local district wildlife managers are employing. So every day when our guys are out there in the communities, they're practicing biology in everything they do. And that goes from, you know, law enforcement, that portion of it, to the habitat projects. a lot of the prescribed burns that we've been seeing around here, you know, in the past 5-6 years. We're working in coordination with our federal land partners. We're working in coordination with our fire agencies. This comes right back into working closely with the different ag communities, the ranches and everything, the private landowners. We've got programs that are specifically addressed at pairing with and partnering with these organizations and with these stakeholders in order to accomplish the greater task of managing wildlife on a landscape level.
For the last, what's it been, 5, maybe 10 years, on Highway 82 and on I-70, there have been a lot of wildlife fences that were put up, obviously, to protect. I mean, it's a huge property damage issue, right? There's a lot of property damage that's done by wildlife on roads, and I know the numbers of animals killed on local roads has probably been decreased because of those fences. Have there been other changes to, like, migratory routes and that kind of thing because of those wildlife fences?
There have. Those fences are specifically aimed – it's kind of a single focus. Those fences are employed by the Colorado Department of Transportation and by Colorado Department of Public Safety, State Patrol, in order to protect people. We don't want people, vehicles colliding with wildlife, and that's to keep wildlife off the roadways. The second part of that is obviously there's the potential for concerns on bisecting or fragmenting wildlife corridors and their movement corridors. For us as an agency, you know, we will speak in and we will articulate what impacts that would have to the wildlife population locally. Whether it's on Highway 82 specifically, we've seen some fences go up in the last few years. Those fences there, the time of year with which they're constructed. You know, we articulate when it would be least impactful to those populations. In addition to that, when you're speaking about some of these valley floors, which is where a lot of our highways and our roadways are, we're not really augmenting, or we're not necessarily altering in a negative capacity where these animals are migrating. Valley floor is, even if a lot of these animals were allowed to cross Highway 82, they wouldn't necessarily, you know, continue their migration for another 20 miles beyond. It may, if they crossed Highway 82, they may get another 400 yards further, but they're going to reside on the valley floor and then return to higher elevations. So the fact that they can't cross those highways isn't 100% detrimental to those species.
Okay. And obviously those fences would not have been built if CPW would have had huge problem with it, because obviously state agencies communicate, or at least we hope, communicate with other state agencies if they feel like they would be impacted in some way.
We do communicate with them, and you know, there are instances where they do have significant impacts on wildlife movement and migration. You know, you mentioned the enforcement capacity of our job. You know, part of our job is also public service and public safety. And in light of, you know, protecting people in this kind of a scenario, if it came down to protecting people and making sure that they're not going to collide with animals and risk injury or death, even at the downfall of the wildlife populations, we would still rank public safety, and that would be a higher priority for us.
When you were talking about that, it brought to mind the question of, they've been doing a study, and the articles that came out, like in the Aspen Times, of 50% less elk in the Roaring Fork Valley and stuff. And I know they're working on a study, and I didn't know if Matt could speak to that, and then maybe a little bit, you know, is that related to the lion study they're doing too, or what is it? Is it our population? Why have we seen these decreases in the elk population and the mule deer, and of course we think about our bighorn sheep population. Well, you know, what are some concerns and projects they have going maybe in the area was something that we were really interested in, and I know they've done some work on the ranch where we reside, where my husband and I reside.
Thanks, Jenny. So speaking to our elk declines, you know, locally here, we are seeing significant declines in our populations, specifically the population that resides in the Frying Pan area over into the Eagle and Vail Valleys. That herd we've seen in the ballpark of 40% population declines in the last decade, maybe 15 years. Those numbers, one of the measures for that herd health is through calf-cow ratios, the number of calves per 100 cows. To sustain a herd, we're looking for numbers in that ballpark of 44 calves per 100 cows just to keep it at status quo. And our three-year – our recent trends have been showing numbers somewhere in the lower 30s, upper 20s of calves per 100 cows. So we're on a steady decline where those populations aren't showing signs of recovery or even being able to recover. So that that leads us to one of the studies that we're conducting here locally. We are in the second year of a six-year study over – this is taking place kind of in the Snowmass, Carbondale areas. Those areas, we're looking at calf elk-calf recruitment and trying to – we're collaring adult cows. We're affixing them with transmitters that whenever they give birth, we are able to track where those calves are being born, place collars on those calves, and then determine if they do survive, what their body condition is, what their movement patterns are, and then if they die, we're able to make field visits and determine what the cause of death is. So – We're in the beginning phases of this study. As you mentioned, as we're speaking right now, our capture crews are currently working up by steamboat, and they're going to be coming into the Roaring Fork Valley here in the next couple of days to continue year two of our captures. We'll hopefully be able to produce some data that will affect and help influence the education, the knowledge of our wildlife managers on how we're managing our elk and why we're making decisions we're making.
I remember years ago seeing a press release that came – I'm trying to remember if it came – I think it came from CDOT talking about all of the interesting exotic species that are killed on Colorado roads throughout the year. And they actually gave numbers of each. I think obviously deer was probably close to the top anyway, but you've also got bear. I remember, five, 6 years ago, somebody hit a bear near the South Canyon exit on I-70. Mountain lions, of course. Squirrels. Actually, I think squirrels was close to the top now that I think about it. But there's somebody that actually keeps track of this at the state level. Just out of curiosity, what's the most exotic species in Area 8 that of any number? Something that we maybe wouldn't expect to actually live in this area.
That's a tough one. most of the animals that we document that we are responding to on our roadways are ones that we know here. I think one of the things that's interesting for most people is while you see deer and occasionally elk getting hit along the roadways, what you don't see or you don't see for very long are the bears and mountain lions. And because of their historical, reclusive nature of those animals, mm-hmm. people just assume that they're not down along the highway corridors. And right. It's not true. Because they have some market value, our staff, if they're killed on the highways, we collect them. We remove them from the highways so that they're not going out and being put on the market. But, annually here, it's out of our Glenwood office, for our officers in the Roaring Fork, Eagle and Vail Valleys, we're on an average year, we're probably collecting 30 to 40 roadkill bears a year. Okay. And people, I don't think people realize that how significant that is. You see it once in a while.
I want to say from the public safety standpoint, if you hit a bear, it's a big deal. I mean, maybe as much as an elk, but a bear weighs, what, twice as much as an elk maybe, depending on the size?
Generally, most of the bears we have around here are, an average female would be somewhere in that 200, 250-pound range,
which
is significantly less than an elk. But it doesn't
– Still.
I don't think – if you look at the damage caused to cars,
right.
it doesn't matter what size it is.
Yeah, okay. And I mentioned the hit on the highway. I meant just in general. Because, it's so interesting. As biologists, where to find all these exotic species and where their habitat is, where, when we're just camping – you have no idea what may be within, 500 feet of your tent.
We always love the bighorn sheep or the, some of that you see. And I know they've had issues. Well, and frankly, we see less mule deer.
Mm-hmm.
We see a lot less mule deer than growing up in Western Colorado, what we used to see. And
I agree.
That's a concern too.
But. And, that just goes back to our declining ungulate populations, ungulates specifically in this sense, meaning deer and elk species and deer as well. We're seeing fewer deer on the landscape than we have historically, just part of a trend that over the last two decades. And we're struggling to maintain these populations. You know, certain people want to see these populations restored to what they were two decades ago, and I think we touched on that earlier, that that may be an unrealistic expectation for the public. So,
what about moose in the area? Remember, was it a year or two ago, the moose that came right through Carbondale, the town of Carbondale, and everybody's excited. I mean, how many, when we first started seeing those around, my brother lives up by Lake City in the summer and manages a ranch up there, and you see them coming through moose.
Moose herd is actually based on the Grand Mesa, right? Isn't that where they, or do they actually live in this area?
We have resident populations of moose in the Roaring Fork Valley, as well as the Vail Valleys, and
but again they're reclusive.
We did have a we reintroduced a herd on the Grand Mesa. This was dating back a while ago, and that population has done very well. They're established and they're starting to explore new territories, which is where we're seeing some of the moose that are coming over from the west end of Glenwood, the Sunlight Ski area. Some of those are transient moose that have migrated this direction. As you get toward the upper Roaring Fork Valley, a lot of those moose are coming out of the Leadville complex, going up over the top of Indy. We have an established herd over there, but over time, our moose population is increasing here. They're novel for us right now in the valley. We haven't had them here forever, and I think with that is going to come a very steep learning curve for the citizens
that
of the valley.
They're not friendly.
One in Estes Park, we had concerns in Montana. We had a moose with its baby that didn't want us around irrigating.
In Yellowstone, and you look it up on YouTube, and you can see any number of. I'm not doing to suggest that they're less intelligent than the rest of us, but
no,
and if the shoe fits, if the hoof fits.
The hard part with moose is that they do appear more docile or less intelligent, that is a misconception. What it comes down to is that there are very few animals, they have very few threats in this world. Humans being pretty much the only ones in whatever capacity. So they're not as skittish or tentative, hesitant around other what we would construe as threats, you know, and where we're used to seeing deer and elk and how they respond to us. Mm-hmm. Moose don't do the same thing. They don't replicate that same behavior. And we as humans interpret that as being friendly or open to our presence. And that's where we are at fault and we get into trouble. And we see that on a routine basis where moose will allow you to approach them. They'll allow you to get close. But like with any wild animal, they have a threshold. And once you breach that threshold, bad things happen. And
especially near calves. Yeah. No good.
There's a disconnect sometimes with wildlife and people that haven't been around wildlife. So.
Okay. Well, as usual, we went way over today. I feel like, so again, you know, we talked a little bit about politics today. Again, Holy Cross Cattlemen's Association is definitely clearly against any wolf reintroduction initiatives. Colorado Parks and Wildlife cannot take a stand on that by statute. And Aspen Valley Land Trust chooses to remain apolitical about anything that is not specific to conservation easements and that kind of thing. So just to be clear. So, Jenny, if anyone would like more information about Holy Cross Cattlemen's, or do you have a website, Facebook page, anything like
Actually,
that?
Actually, usually how they get a hold of me is by calling me, so I'll give my number out here. But it's 970-318-0076. Okay. But you can look at rethinkwolves.com. You can look at betterwithbeef.org. We've got that out there as part of being CCA. And when you were talking about elk numbers, it brought to mind that the Yellowstone elk herd was depleted down from 19,000 pre-wolves in 1994 to just below 4,000 in their numbers now. So that, you know, that is a concern when we talk about it, because we already have that. They have less. Their calfhood survival is 20 to 1. I don't know, is that how you mention it? But they have 20 instead of like the 44s. That's the goal. So, you know, these are all concerns, and we all want to work together, and we don't want to be, you know, fighting with our neighbors any things, but we just want folks to know that it is a concern, and we're trying to take care of the wildlife, and keeping ranches in business to take care of the wildlife is important to us.
And Matt, CPW is just cpw.state.co.us. Is it more complicated than that?
It's not. You know, locally here, we've been encouraging people to get on Facebook, and our area has a Facebook page that for specific information and facts relevant to what's going on here, we've been trying to reference people back to that. We try to keep it up to date, you know, at least weekly, if not daily, just so that people know. It's not necessarily speaking to issues that are going on with wildlife management on the Front Range, but we want to make sure that people here know what's happening in their backyards.
And again, Area 8 would be, you said, Roaring Fork Valley, Eagle, and Vail. And so Area 9 is also in this area, but that's slightly different, right?
Correct. Area 9 is based out of Hot Sulphur Springs. That's Kremling, Middle Park, that area.
Okay. So that would be like north of I-70
As you start getting to Summit County and then heading up north to Grand County, it's Summit and Grand Counties essentially.
Okay. And then Area 7, of course, would be Grand Junction.
Grand Junction, pretty much rifle west to the state border.
Okay. Again, cpw.state.co.us, or search Facebook for
Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Glenwood Springs.
Okay. There you go.
And Colorado Cattlemen's does have a Facebook page, too,
okay,
that you can look at. And we're working on one with Holy Cross, but we're limited as volunteers to get that done.
And Suzanne, Aspen Valley Land Trust, AVLT.org.
You got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you can learn more there. Do you have I feel like I've picked on you the least out of anybody today.
I got lucky.
Yeah, right. picked on being an interesting choice of words, I suppose, too. Aspen Valley Land Trust, AVLT.org. Obviously, you always have deals that are in the works. Obviously, you can't talk specifics until everybody has signed on the dotted line, but do you have anything really exciting going right now?
We do. We have a lot of exciting projects going, but on a larger scale, we spent last year doing a new strategic plan, and as part of that, we did a lot of public outreach trying to find out what it is the community's concerned about. And as it turns out, population growth and development was kind of tops on that list. Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, wildlife habitat was right up there in the top three. Climate change was also a top concern, which all of this also feeds into. Clearly, ranches are often really beneficial in this category because they are perennial grasslands, shrub and trees, which all help to capture carbon. But beyond that, this has all led into a wider conservation planning effort that AVLT is currently engaged in. And that is really built around trying to figure out where the most important corridors are to protect if we do want to save room for wildlife to migrate from the high country down to the valley bottoms, as well as for ranchers to be able to operate in an area that has enough viable ranch land next door that it all works together and people aren't getting into conflicts. So in general, I'd say thanks to all our partners. These guys have both been great partners over the years. Thanks to all of the citizens and individuals and ranchers and landowners out there who care. And this is work that needs to continue. So
Thank you, Suzanne.
What are the prerequisites for AVLT to look at a parcel to conserve, to put a conservation easement on? What is there a checklist per se?
There is a checklist, but really what it comes down to is conservation value. So
okay,
what is it that matters about this piece of property that would cause us to protect it? There can be a piece of property that's an acre in size that has public value if, say, it's a public park.
Gotcha.
Or it helps protect access to somewhere.
So it doesn't have to be these
full section
parcels.
Doesn't have to be a giant sprawling ranch.
Okay.
But so we do. We look on the landscape scale for these big ranches that help to connect together our ecosystem. And we also look at the community scale to see where these little sort of green infrastructure pieces can be inserted to help make life better on a daily basis.
Thank you all again. By the way, just due to the content today, we're going to end up editing this out a lot to make it fit the time that we have available. So if you'd like to hear the entire interview, we'll post it on our website for anybody that's interested, because really some interesting stuff. I feel bad that we have to do that, but it is what it is, right?
Well, we can come back another time.
Only so much time.
Yeah.
You're welcome to come back anytime the three of you would like.
Thank you.
Matt, stay safe. It's great to meet you.
Thanks.
Jenny, all the best. Suzanne, we'll talk to you soon, I know, as well.
Thanks,
Thanks again.
Appreciate it.
Have a wonderful day.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to KMTS Connections, a public affairs program from KMTS News, heard weekdays around 12:30. It's another reason we are the most listened to radio station from Rifle to Aspen.